floodgates. It's time to welcome the river. The river of life.
You are listening to the Go Health Podcast. The Go Health Podcast seeks to explore stories, how people have found healing, and how we can learn from them, from their stories of human flourishing, some ordinary, some extraordinary. I'm Gillian Strain, and I run the Guild of Health and St. Raphael. And today I am chatting with the Reverend Lucy Ann Ashton. Lucy Ann has had a really interesting career so far. She is a trained midwife, a Church of England priest, an academic, and has been a hospice chaplain in her time. She is also the chair of the Guild of Health in St. Raphael. And so Lucy Ann and I have known each other for over 5 years now. So full disclosure, this is not the first time we've met, right, Lucy Ann?
Absolutely, Gillian.
So welcome to the podcast. And what we do on the podcast is we try to tell our stories about what's made us who we are. But first of all, can you just tell everyone a bit more about your journey? I've done the headlines. I wonder if you can fill in the gaps with how you've got to where you are today.
Well, from quite a young age, I had a desire to either teach or be a health professional. And I think the health professional bit came because when I was about six, I had I nearly died, had to be hospitalised with peritonitis, and I was in a long time, and the nurse that took my stitches out was really, really lovely, and I think they just inspired me, and but I didn't realise at the time that that was a conscious thing. Mm. But there was a real kindness to the way that they were with me, as well as giving me really good care and saving my life. So I went into nursing and really loved the midwifery stint. And I think what appealed to me was that it was about a normal life event. It wasn't about trying to cure people, wonderful though that is, or making people better. And that's all great too. But for me, there was something about people who were doing a normal life event, plus the person I went out with. I did a long placement with a community midwife, and she was right at the heart of her community, and she'd been there for years. People knew her, you know, someone would have a baby and then she'd know the grandchild of the woman and so on. And that really appealed. And then around the time when I applied, there was quite a controversial case. So that kind of where a woman consultant was being taken to court by her colleagues for being very, in my view, for being very woman-centered. So I chose to train there because I thought, oh, that would be a really interesting place to work. And that really woke me up, I think, to kind of issues of health and inequality and injustice, particularly for women, but for wider issues around society. And so I really enjoyed being a home birth midwife and working kind of in the NHS and independently. And did a bit of teaching right from the word go. One of my tutors encouraged me to teach. She thought I had a bit of a gift for it. So kind of as a fledgling, newly qualified midwife, I was doing all sorts of parent education and then teaching colleagues. And I really loved it. It was really enjoyable and good reflective space. I enjoy that aspect of it. And then came my own inability to have children. That made it quite hard to continue with practice. I'd get home, you know, after sort of 24 hours up, and I'd be, you know, as one is when one's tired, a bit overwrought from being exhausted, but also just aware that I was really raw. So I went into teaching full time in the university, which was really great, and learned that you learn so, you know, the students are such a resource. They teach you so much. And during that time, you know, my faith has always been important to me, and I grew up in a Christian community where the reason that the people who looked after me did what they did was because they thought that was part of their faith service. And that, I think that has been through me like a stick of rock with me hardly noticing. And so I was aware that the kind of areas of faith and spirit and health were beginning more to be more separated out. And that didn't sit with me, because for me internally they were integrated. And so as part of my own journey to think about, well, what would I do with the energy that I would put into mothering? And what do I do with this kind of desire to offer holistic, integrated care? My husband, James, was thinking about ordination, and we were going together to explore that. And I kind of went in my own right to explore. And then I kind of came away thinking, oh, no, that's a bit scary being a public good person. Maybe I'll leave that for a bit. And then as happens, you know, I kind of had this internal nagging until I did something about it. So eventually was ordained in 2008. And then whilst I was working in my first incumbency, which was in an area where there was a very high age profile, I was working with a lot of people who were on their way to death. And I had always thought that if I stopped being a midwife, I might quite like to do hospice care. And that's interesting because before midwifery was professionalised, the local women and handy women, as they were called, would be called on to greet the newborns, help women give birth and to lay out the dead. So it feels like there is a kind of historical pattern there somewhere. And I happened to be talking to a friend of mine about something completely different. She had no idea I was thinking about hospice, and she said, oh, did you know this job was going at this hospice? And I said, oh, no. So applied and really loved it. I mean, it's demanding, it's challenging, but it is also really rewarding, and it's an enormous privilege. And it sounds a bit cliched and it's hard to articulate well, but there are resonances between the birth-death journey. Both have a mirror of each other in them as well. There's lots of loss when you change roles and become a parent, and there's lots of potential for discovering new things and reconnecting with life in a different way when you're on the journey to dying. And obviously that's not always true for everybody, so I don't want to make it sound saccharine. So that's a sort of potted history.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah. It seemed to me as somebody who's been, I don't even know if this is a word, but an alongsider.
Yeah.
Alongside folk giving birth, alongside folk dying, you haven't, alongside folk teaching, and you haven't mentioned you're trained in supervision, so alongside professional development as well. Because often birth and death, particularly in modern society, people keep them completely far apart. And sort of make up myths about them. You know, birth was supposed to be, you know, pink and fluffy and lovely. Reality is quite different for many people. And death, we don't talk about. But actually, you as an individual, what was that word you used? The women, kind of folk women who used to do this.
Yeah, the handy women. Yes,
handy women. Yeah,
yeah.
Can you say more about the parallels between the two and what you've learned?
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting what you said about pink and fluffy, and then we don't talk about it, because interestingly, both of them, in a way, would have been at the heart of our communities. You know, historically, people would have grown up being around birth and feeding and being around death and dying, you know, quite often. And in some places, this still happens. You know, the coffin would have been in the house for a week or more. And I mean, in fact, a friend of mine, after her husband died, decided she was going to go into business with hiring coffins that have fridges, so that if people wanted to have their loved ones in their houses for longer, especially in the summer, they could. So there was that sort of sense of them both being at the heart of what we did and what we knew. And there's one of my favorite writers, Philip Ariès, in his book Western Attitudes to Dying, or something like, I might have got that wrong, Western Attitudes to Death, he talks about how we think we have tamed death by taking it out of the home and putting it into a hospital or hospice. But actually what we've done is terrify ourselves. And there's a similar thing with birth, because we know that, for example, postnatal depression is often higher when women, and this is increasingly the norm anyway, when women haven't got any, they've, you know, potentially had a career, given birth, haven't got the networks, don't have, you know, they might be very competent people, but they just don't have the networks or the support around them for that transition. And we would have been globally, but also local, you know, in our own nation, much better at having a communal wisdom about transition, in a way that we don't now. So we're more anxious, and we reach for technological solutions. And also there would not have been a split between understanding a life in the spirit and a life in the body. They would have gone together, and, you know, there would have been really heroic deaths, you know, not all, don't say I'm not glorifying them, but they would have, people would have thought about things like that. And even now in palliative care, we might talk about a good death, but that's not always a good death if you're the one on the receipt, you know, the bereaved. They might have been peaceful, they might not have been agitated, but you're still bereft. So how is that good, you know? And a good birth might mean, oh, the woman did it how she wanted, and yet may still be shocked by the kind of power and trauma of the event. So I think there are kind of parallels in that sense for me. And also in the way that, that both of them challenge us, really challenge us to think about where we're at. I mean, one of my things that I used to notice was supporting women giving birth is that there was a real opening for both them and the partner, real opening. Where am I with the planet? You know, people often then thought about where food was coming from, what this meant for people all over the world. So there was a kind of connection that went, and I used to call it, it was really generative. It wasn't just about giving birth. There was something phenomenologically generative about it as well. And you saw people birthing themselves, not just as parents, but something often came to the fore that probably, I suspect, wouldn't have been evoked. And also with dying, you know, I'm always humbled by watching carers. Oh, it's making me feel a bit tearful. People who think they can't do another day, another hour, and they do, and they stay and they find resources of love that they didn't know they had. And again, it evokes different things in people. I remember one woman I accompanied, she stands out in my mind and probably always will. She'd been a head teacher and had just retired and got a diagnosis and was dying very fast. And she was so muscular. She was like a marathon runner, and she was delving deep into her spirit and wanted to get everything right in herself and with her relationships so that she could die, having tied up her loose ends, if you like. And as a result of that, a core member of her family needed to see me because he wanted to confess something, because he felt that he needed to do it for her as well as himself. He couldn't let her die with that unfinished business in his own life, which she knew nothing about. But again, there's that sense of, what does life mean in the light of death? And also, bereavement sends us on such an incredible journey of evaluation and distilling of what matters.
I'm really struck listening to you describe and tell stories to illustrate both your experience of birth and of people dying. And I start, especially the birth stories. I when I was pregnant, the only person that ever told me the truth was an academic. He'd had four children, first child, and we were like, oh, what's it like? What's it like? And he just said, it's apocalyptic. He was the only one that got close to the experience, as far as I was concerned, of what it was like. And we sort of sweep the real challenges under the carpet now. So I think it's so important to bring those stories out for our general health. But I was struck there. So you're telling me stories about birth and death. I was struck by your language of these are moments of transition for the person as well as the spectators or people around it. Regenerative, and birth is generative, not just getting a baby, but your whole vision of the world changes. So there, your description of carers as finding resources of love and people finding reconciliation while they're dying. So transition, generative, love and reconciliation. These are all words I use all the time when I talk about the healing ministry.
Yeah.
So can you tell me more about how all this beautifully sweeps up now, and you're the chair of a healing charity and leading us through a transition of our own as well. So what's healing mean to you?
Well, as you know, that's a big one, isn't it?
Blessings flow. Blessings flow.
Well, it's fascinating because we're doing this recording just after the wonderful lecture by Ruth Harvey, Dennis Duncan. And in my early career, I did think that I had a call to healing, the healing ministry. And as I've got older, I've kind of let that go. And I think partly I just thought that feels a bit arrogant. But actually, something about her talk reconnected me with that. And I think partly because when you work in the kind of paid health professions, it's easy to think that you're not part of healing. I don't know why that is. That's nuts, I know, but there you go. I think, well, certainly for me, although I do believe in it and I saw it when I was younger, that it can mean cure and it can, there can be miracles. I think it's so much more subtle than that often. It can be a relationship that's been broken, becoming some way towards healing. It might be completely healed. It might be a bridge to healing. It may be reconnecting with yourself. It may be a deep acceptance of where you are in your illness, in your parenting, in your health. And I suppose the word I like biblically, I like shalom. I like that kind of well-being, which for me is not the absence of illness or suffering. I think it's perfectly possible to be, have well-being, have a deep sense of shalom and peace and value in the midst of immense suffering. And that there's segues into another story. Stories are great, aren't they? I remember going to see a really lovely man in a care home in Essex, and it was amazing. All of the care staff were coming and going and telling their stories because he prayed for everybody in the care home. So I went to see him as an end of life visit, not imminent, but you know, kind of pending in the next few months, and we had a chat about what was going on for him, and then it was reciprocal. What can I pray for you?
Wonderful.
And I found that deeply challenging, you know, and I had to do the kind of shift in me. Okay, do I just kind of like keep the professional boundary? And I thought that's dishonoring because here he is. And obviously I didn't over disclose or anything like that, but it was obvious to me that this man was expressing a calling. Mm-hmm. And he was providing peace, healing, solace to those staff. It was profound. So I think there is something in the core of sense making, meaning making and purpose, that can be deeply healing. And that doesn't mean that you have to be fit and active and out there making it happen. It's about kind of knowing deep in your being, for me that you are loved, valued, and that can happen in a variety of settings, can't it? So it can obviously and does and needs to be the absence of illness for some people, or certainly, I mean, you know, for example, cancer treatments these days, it's wonderful, isn't it? People are living so much longer. I mean, it doesn't come without, it's necessarily without great anxiety or whatever, but we have got so good at helping people to reach a different level of life and living. So I think it's so multi-layered, and I think it's tied up with creation as well. And for me, I suppose when I read what the Bible says about salvation, it's always about healing, and it's always all of it. It's people, animals, plants, you know, the rivers. I can't separate them out. And that's why I love that awareness that I saw of women saying, oh, you know, what am I going to feed my baby? And how does that impact the planet? And what about other nations and other people having babies? And there's sort of, it's almost like, you know, the mycelium, I don't understand it much, but I love that image of the mycelium underneath the ground, sending messages and healing. And it for me, there's something of that.
Yeah. It's almost like a consciousness raising, isn't it? You suddenly see yourself as part of creation and of what you do is matter rather than an isolated self.
Yes.
We're encouraged through lots of different ways to think of ourselves.
And I suppose there's a sort of, you know, without wanting to get all esoteric, there's mysticism in that, because there's something about recognizing that there isn't a dualism. We are one.
Yeah.
We're one with our beloved divine. We're one with one another and the planet.
Mm.
And, you know, we have this Celtic phrase, don't we? Thin places. And I suppose birth and death, you have a window where you can kind of feel that, and you can feel it close.
Mm. Wow.
I can remember sort of doing postnatal visits and thinking, oh, it's closed now. Mm. The aperture is closed.
Mm.
and also not getting, it's challenging not getting hooked on that, being open. It is what it is, and it's living with that. Okay. So I don't know if I've answered your question.
Very cool answer, and illustrates so well how the healing ministry is so much more than getting better. It's all that you just said. And it's, I mean, I came across a quotation recently that health is the strength to live. The strength to live in bodies that sometimes go wrong. And it's the strength to die. It's about connection with the journey that we're on. In terms of your journey, I wondered if you'd be prepared to speak about what sounds like a really painful aspect of your life with being a midwife and then finding yourself unable to have children yourself. And I'm asking because I know many listeners will be maybe going through that journey or coming out the other end of that journey. And I wonder whether you can offer some wisdom and some stories about how people can find healing broadly understood as the hand that they found themselves being dealt.
I think if you'd have asked me that about 5 years ago, I might not be in a good place to do that. But I think the first thing that I would say is it's lovely to be asked, because it's not something that you very often get asked to talk about. It's often a conversation stopper rather than a conversation that people want to have. Probably a bit like telling somebody that you've just been diagnosed, you know, it's one of those cross the street things.
Yeah, shut down. That's interesting though, even there. People say, how are, you know, often say, do you have family? I mean, it's part of our how are you kind of conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
But a question to get if that's something.
Exactly. I think in my context, there's two things that sort of came together. So I live with my hubby, James, who lives with chronic illness. And we were sort of coming to that, kind of trying to find some way of living with that in the early years of our marriage. And so I alluded to earlier having surgery when I was 6, and that led on to me having a lot of problems with my ovaries. So when I was about 34, 35, I ended up having, I'd already had surgery on one ovary when I was 20, and then really big bit of surgery when I was about 35. And I think the gynae team, I think, thought, oh, this is fine, you know, it'll be fine. And it was a really fascinating thing. Because it also set up quite a lot of ambivalence in me, because I think sometimes, particularly if you're thoughtful and you think about it, and I know I looked after a woman who wrote a book, Kate Moss, not the model, wrote a book called Becoming a Mother. And she talked about talking to women about the decision. And often people don't make a decision, you know, it's a kind of non-decision. And I remember because I'd kind of been the eldest and because of our circumstances, I'd felt very responsible for my siblings. There was a part of me that didn't know if I could do parenting again, but in a different context. And I remember talking to one of the locum GPs, and I knew him from working at the hospital. And I said, I just don't know whether I want to do infertility treatment. And he said, I know. And I told him why. And he said, oh, yeah, my sister felt like that. That was so amazing. No judgment, just really heard me. But what it did was it set up a really huge process of bereavement that I think I went in the acute phase of it. For me, I knew I was passionate, but I didn't kind of realize quite how passionate until I went on that journey. And it lasted about 17 years. And it raised all sorts of questions. Was I really a woman now? I felt I lost my identity as a midwife at the same time because I couldn't stay in the work easily. And it was what I knew. People told me I was good at it. I loved it. So it felt like there was a kind of wrenching of a huge part of life that was really difficult to come to terms with. I learned that I was very hard on myself in my grief. So I learned a lot about who I am. And the thing that I found most difficult was it didn't really feel like a grief. So later, via Gateway Women and Jodie Day, bless her, I went to a Reignite weekend and I learned about disenfranchised grief. And if a society doesn't recognise something as grief, it's very difficult for you to accommodate your own grief. That was huge. I mean, I don't know. I think I got a lot more out of that weekend, but that was the thing that really helped enormously. And also listening to other women's stories and knowing that you weren't alone and that it was happening to women very young and women much older. you know, that was still trying to come to terms with this. So there was a long journey of thinking about it. Sent me on a real journey about what do I believe about death and life after death. Do I believe in life after death? You know, all the questions that people that I work with in palliative care are asking all the time. What did I think about burial, cremation, my mortality? Was my life worth anything anymore? That really came hard and fast, like a kind of, I think the image that comes to mind is as though I was under Niagara Falls and I just couldn't even breathe with the pain and loss of it. And then I think I've always been somebody who's been quite embodied and who likes to run and walk and eat well. And I think, you know, I became aware that although I still did that, my tendency to care for myself well was reduced. And that we know that about grief, you know, that's what happens. So it caused me to question everything about who I was and how I understood the world and work. And then also one of my favorite times of the year had always been Advent. And I felt like I lived that story regularly in my life, you know, like I was doing Advent with people every time I did a journey to birth. And all of a sudden, I just found it really painful. All this talking about babies and miraculous ones, you know, virgin births and people having babies at 100. And so there was a kind of, it changed my relationship to scripture. Yeah. So it was tectonic.
And it sounds a huge questioning of your, or reassessing of your whole identity.
Yeah.
Past and future and where you are now. And
yeah.
And if you could wave a magic wand, I mean, we don't have magic wands at the Guild of Health, Sir Raphael. but, you know, what changes at a societal level, and let's talk about the church, at the church level, what practical things people list, what would you demand would change to make it easier for people struggling with childlessness or living with that? And also let's move and talk about and the church. What could we do better?
Well, one of the things that I know is being campaigned for is that childless people are given space in a kind of HR law so that you're not the one that always does the half term working if you're the childless one, for example. So things like that where we make assumptions about who's available to do things. So the term pronatalism comes in, and it's a bit like going on holiday and different surcharges, so that sort of thing.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know if this is true, but I have a hunch that because I was a midwife for such a long time, I have a slightly different perspective because I spent so much of my life around that, and I have so much of it beagled into who I am still. I think the way we talk about women's choices is really complex. Because especially now while we're talking about embryo freezing, I don't always think we're honest about the complexities of reproductive technology or the actual choices that we have. We can't have it all, and we'd like to give the impression we can. It's not possible. Something has to give. Even if you're high achiever and you do achieve, you know, what other people might think all of it. So I think there needs to be a bit more honest conversation about that. And whilst I'm not a biological reductionist, I do think there is something in the biology that needs to be more honestly acknowledged around timings and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, now we're into a very complex area, which I'm not sure I've got a handle on, which is, you know, the whole place of gender fluidity and how that plays into it. I think awareness that it's an area of deep grief. The amount of women across the world that are infertile now, especially in the Western world, is as high as it was after the First World War. So the factual information around it is quite profoundly shocking. And I think if churches want to have a ministry, then there's something to be done around supporting couples who would have liked to have had children and being really cognizant of we've got a lot of nativity type language in our stories. And what does that mean? And I'm aware that the story of Hannah, when she's crying out to God, you know, she's treated as though she's slightly bonkers. And there, for me, there's something there about the really visceral expression of grief and longing and yearning. And we need to be better at hearing people's real deep distress and not sanitizing it, because I think we have a tendency to get a bit sort of closing down if people are really distraught or enraged. I was so enraged. I didn't know what to do with the amount of rage in my sorrow. And for me, the thing I still don't feel I've got my own head around, but I would like to get better at it, is lament. If we had much more lament in our liturgy, in our culture, and songs, all of that artistic expression of lament, I think I would have found that very holding, both at societal level and in our churches. Because there's something about grief that makes you feel like you're all the colour's gone out of the world. And if you're someone who brings that news, you're asked the question and then your news is bad news or news that challenges, you know, oh gosh, not everyone might have a baby, or I might get cancer or MND or whatever. That threatens us when we hear that news. But that is the reality of human life. And it's not just that colour or that absence, but something about being more able to hear the different inflections of life's journey, and to incorporate that in our liturgy and our worship, and just to be better at loss. I don't even know what I mean when I say better at loss, but more that we incorporate it more. And and maybe COVID is going to be, maybe that's one of the things that COVID will do, I don't know. I think the danger is that we get too scared and it does the opposite, but it's probably a mixed picture.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the church, in terms of sort of thinking about another whole area, which is child loss and the stillbirth and so on, I feel the church has taken good steps in developing Blue Christmas or services, especially in Advent, for people who've suffered the death of a child. And that's important. So it feels like there's a space for that to be expanded into a different form of grief as well. So there's been improvements, but whether or not the liturgy is any good, or if there's spaces for those stories to be heard, it's getting in that's a hard bit. And some training. I mean, it's very interesting in developing one of our projects at the Guild, is the Healthy Healing Hub project. And I was surprised, but so many of our churches we're working with are asking for training for people to have tricky conversations, to know how to say, how are you, or to ask, how are you, and be available for the answer. Because we're dealing with death on a huge level, uncertainty on a huge level. And really, we're being tested now as Christians, I feel. Do we really believe what we're preaching?
Absolutely. Time? Absolutely. It's interesting because two things that you evoked me. One is that I think it's 2 years ago when the NHS was 70, I was on my way to an event at Chelmsford Cathedral because I was working in Chelmsford Diocese as a chaplain. And I was on the way there, had an hour's journey, and I was just really reflecting and feeling so grateful for the fact that having trained in the NHS had given me so much, given me my career and, you know, so much. And I just went with it. My heart was open and full. And I'd also been, I was part of a little group that had helped plan the service. There was a point in it where we heard a story of a young lad who was six who'd been saved. And on video, they showed us meeting this consultant. It was really moving. At the end, there was an opportunity for people to go into either of the side chapels and just lay a stone. And the one I went into had this young lad and his dad in it. And I lay my stone and it hit me like a brick. That actually, I might not have been able to have children, but actually the NHS saved my life when I was six, the same age as this lad. And it sort of shifted something for me, that I had been given the gift of life. And the price for that was that I couldn't give life in a biological sense. And that gave me a level of healing. And I think it's probably ongoing, a bit like grief, you know, there are layers, but there's something. And even now, if I contemplate it, it blows my mind and I can feel my heart soften. So there's something quite profound in that. And it feels very poignant when you're talking about the NHS. Because this is what we're talking about, this COVID thing, isn't it? And when I heard about the second lockdown, the first thing that came to my mind is, how are those staff going to do this? They must be so exhausted, you know, because they're really well trained, but we're all, like you said, how do you say how you are? We're all exhausted. We're holding a much greater awareness of uncertainty than we ever consciously normally do, even though it's always around. You know, we're all behaving differently with our weird face masks. And if you're wearing PPE, every day in a hot environment. And the thing that you like to do well, which is to smile or to touch or reassure, you know, and it's all going as well as it can, but I don't think we're going to know for a long, long time quite the toll it's taken. And that's where my mind went, is what what will be the fallout? And it will be mixed, I think, good, bad and indifferent. What will we have learned? You know, I mean, amazing, isn't it? How we've never developed a vaccine in this kind of time frame before, kind of a bit like war, you know, accelerates things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I do really hope with all my heart that we learn the value of those people and that we learn what a gift we have from God in the way that we can be with one another, with our gifts and skills, you know, whether that's science or biology, or whether you just happen to be a really good ward cleaner who knows how to have the most amazing conversations by the bedside, whatever that is, I know I'm not the only one, but I hope it does have a reorientating impact and that we do start to think differently and more creatively about lament and loss and death and how we can be with each other in it, because there's a much more universal experience of it, even though it will be particularly different, won't it? But there'll be a larger awareness, and there's things we won't be proud of, won't there, like what we know about some groups being treated less equally than others and so on.
I read there's a British Medical Journal article that spoke recently in October 2020 about the mental health impact of COVID, and one line that I'm not the one to remember lines, but one line has stuck with me, that there is no vaccine for the mental health impact of what we're going through. And the way you were describing it there, actually, before you even said lament, it sounded like the Psalms. What we're living through right now is one of those lament Psalms. My God, my God, why have you forsaken us? How long, O Lord? How long?
Yes. Yes.
Sort of, we read them, especially we're both Church of England priests. You know, you have them every day. You have to say, oh gosh, no, not that psalm. It goes on forever. Oh Lord, we've got to say it all again. But actually, a number of wise women in my life have been pointing me back to the Psalms, you know, and not to that, oh, look here, this will make it better. But like, this is actually describing the disorientation we are having right now. The need to hang, you know, where is the certainty and the uncertainty? Where is God? Do we believe? And one of the Psalms, I will never remember the number, but there's one very repetitive Psalms that basically went through the whole history of the Jews. You know, we went through history, but God saved us. We were exiled for 40 years, but God saved us. We were then into this bit, but God saved us. And I'd always thought it was a rather boring Psalm, but a friend of mine pointed to this. This is the recitation of the history so that they can carry on believing. Well, God was with us then. Surely he must be with us now.
Yeah.
And not in a kind of statement of fact, or here's a historical lesson. We need to know this now. And what you said there, but coming out of it, it's not going to be a quick fix. It's not going to be sudden. We're all on a journey now.
And I think I find the Psalms really important, and they're really important in the work I do. And I think going back to something I said earlier, for me, you know, they're really viscerally uncomfortable at times. And I'm not condoning that, but, you know, you might have smite their babies or something. It's really uncomfortable for us in the West. But what that is that's rage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not necessarily that you want that to happen. But actually, when we're really enraged and when we're really bereaved, we can wish things that we then go, oh, my goodness, I didn't even know I had it in me to think like that. And that's the other reason why they're important, because we are faced then with all of who we are. And there's no escape. We have a very good friend who grew up in Lebanon, and we go there, and there, you know, everything's like high octane. I love it. I love it. You know, it's something about that kind of, in the Middle East, that is allowed. That's all out there, you know, and it's deeply uncomfortable, but it's how it is. And I suppose for me, it's a bit like, you know, Jesus saying, those among you without sin, cast the first stone. Or Gandhi saying, don't get involved in nonviolent work with me if you don't know about your own violence. And I think that's what's so amazing about the Psalms, is it's all of it there, isn't it? Our despair, our constant repetition that, yeah, actually God has been there. I might be getting paranoid that I've lost, you know, he's gone completely now, but it's all there. And we've got a tendency to sort of, understandably, but we need to be, I think we could be a bit more courageous and a bit more careful about how we do it. But the Psalms, we get very, there are Psalms we never have in the lectionary, aren't there? Mm. As well as the ones you get, like you say, oh no, not that one again, which is interesting. Psalm 88 is a classic one because there's no resolution in it. It's, you know, it's really pit of despair stuff. Mm. But actually, if that's where you are, it meets you.
We are mid pandemic, we're mid the second lockdown. And just drawing this to a close, you've had enormous experiences. You've been this wise woman of transition moments.
Mm.
What gives you hope today to carry on? Where do you place your hope?
There's something about this moment for me which feels a bit more real than we sometimes are. And I like that. So that makes me feel hopeful, because it feels like there's a real life in the middle of it. And I'm not saying that without, I don't want that to be in any way dismissive of the horrendous pain and anguish and grief and anxiety and fear that we're all living with in, you know, depending on our circumstances. I think, you know, crisis is always an opportunity as well. And I have seen and felt people move towards each other. They've told me when I did a little spell at the beginning of lockdown for 6 months, covering an interregnum, and I ended on Harvest Sunday. And I said, can you email me telling me what your COVID harvest has been to date? And without exception, people talked about a distillation of what mattered, what was important, and where things that helped them to connect had arisen. It was very profound. And I think I echo that. And for me, I feel like I'm somebody who's quite via negativa. So, you know, I'm not great with words always, but there's something in that dark place for me that always thinks that's where stuff's growing and you can't see it. There's a mixed bag there, but I have something in me just senses some life. And I suppose for me, it's that wonderful image of creation, of uncreated light, of the spirit hovering over what's not yet visible. So there's something really profound in that for me.
Just said, I'm not somebody who's very good with words. I have just recorded a podcast with you and otherwise. Lucianne, thank you so much for being willing to share your stories and your experience in life. It's been a profound privilege to listen to you. Now, we've worked together for 5 years. We've never had this conversation.
No, we haven't.
But thank you so much. I feel that to whoever listens to it, it will be of enormous value to them. So thank you for being willing to share.
Thank you for asking.
You have been listening to the Go Health podcast. Our theme music is from the song River of Life by Lofter. To continue the conversation and to find out more about the Go Health community, go to our website, gohealth.org.uk, and find us also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And there, join in the conversation, because together we flourish.